Welcome back to Computer Science E259. This is Lecture 7, HTTP 1.1, Java Server Pages 2, and Java Servlet 2.4. My name is David Malin, and last week, this worked well when we did a bit of review, so I thought we would begin here yet again. Last week, we had quite the laundry list of topics, but last week, we had only these three primary new topics, so this should be a piece of cake. So perhaps in the order that they are given, tell me something interesting about namespaces in XML. Namespaces are not actually URLs. So though the world has tended to standardize on using what look like URIs or URLs as these strings, really that's only so that they are ultimately unique and so that you can sort of trust that your choice of namespaces isn't going to collide with someone else's. Give me one more interesting thing or one more, let's say, frustrating thing that several of you probably stumbled across during Project 2. Something along the lines of way too many of those, perhaps? So a few heads are nodding. So hopefully you were able to get rid of those in the end. What was Xalen outputting this attribute value pair for in some contexts?
Yeah. When I use helper templates,
okay.
And I didn't have the namespace in the
Okay, so when you used helper templates and you didn't have this default XMLNS or a XMLNS namespace defined for that template, you were probably getting the effect of these being peppered throughout your output. The reason being, if you didn't have a default namespace for instance, this helper template, well, its namespace was just going to be the quote-unquote empty string namespace, and so Xalen was outputting this because previously, probably in your main template, if you had such a thing, there was a specific namespace associated with other elements in your document, like the SVG namespace or something else, the XHTML namespace. So Xalen's behavior was correct in that it was trying to override the previous namespace, but you wanted some consistency, and usually the easiest fix was just to make sure that if in your templates or in your top-level element, you had a default namespace for SVG or XHTML defined. Realize that you experienced some frustration with this, and I'll probably change this if we use this project again in the future. The fact that we were using xtube.xsl to output conditionally either XHTML or SVG, I think was in large part why you felt this frustration, because almost all of our other examples have defined an XMLNS attribute, but in the root element of the style sheet, the XSL style sheet element, and putting it way up there pretty much covers all the cases throughout your style sheet, all of your templates. So I apologize if that was some undue frustration, but I didn't say too much at the time because it actually, I think, does reinforce what these things are actually doing and why they were being outputted. So hopefully you did conquer that. SVG, give me something interesting. Oh, come now. That was the fun part of the project, I thought. Okay, so you can use math to make any kind of shape you want. You also have the fact that they are grounded in vectors, which means they scale quite nicely. Most of you probably opted to display, if you thought through it to this extent, probably chose some default canvas, as we've been calling it, of maybe 800 pixels wide or 1024 or something like that, so that the map probably, for many of you, displayed at least within a screenful, but it was probably so darn small you couldn't really read anything until you actually zoomed in. So that was an appropriate design decision, but when you did zoom in, it probably looked quite clean, except for perhaps the labels, which are non-trivial to rearrange, if even possible, using SVG alone. Give me one interesting thing about FO. That's complimentary. Well, what's it good for? What can you use it for? So you can generate PDFs because it's sort of a language-independent mechanism for marking up things aesthetically and then outputting it as any number of formats, including PDF or PostScript or any other number, ASCII text even. What you'll find, unfortunately, that though FOP is from the Apache project, which tends to be pretty current with regard to the specifications, you may have found that there are a number of features in XSLFO that simply are not supported by FOP. And you might have seen in the output of FOP, italics is not supported, or sorry, this font is not supported. And don't worry so much about those details, but just do realize that at least so far as FOP's concerned, even if you were getting such messages, they should have been warnings, not errors. If you were getting errors, there was probably something else at play, but just realize that it's not the most thorough implementation. But with that said, we will use FOP again via its Java API for Project 4, when for our Scamazon project, you'll generate purchase orders or receipts of sorts as PDFs, but using a small bit of XSLFO. So we'll come back to that. But we'll give you a bit of a break with it from it for Project 3. Any questions on last time? No? All right. Well, we've indulged tonight, so we have two other boxes of Rice Krispie Treats, so help yourself as we proceed. Tonight is fun because we finally segue from the client-side environment of XML and all things related to the server side, which is where we will ultimately stay for the rest of the course. So this is really our turning point, where projects 3, 4, and most likely your final project will have some sort of server flair to them. What we will do tonight is introduce a couple of components of J2EE, particularly those that we'll be drawing upon for some demos and for projects 3 and 4, and focus again our attention on all things server related. And so we begin our chat with HTTP, because there are certain mechanisms in HTTP that ultimately make projects 3 and 4, and really any of the web applications you might think of today, possible. So first of all, what is HTTP? It's the easy question. Right? You type it every day, probably, or at least you see it every day. Transport protocol, hypertext transport protocol, transfer protocol. So what does it do? Okay, good. So in the one hand, we can take the obvious, which is transports hypertext, but that's not even somewhat true anymore because HTTP is actually used for so many other things, for tunneling reasons, for other protocols, for SOAP and so forth. So more generally, HTTP is like the language that clients and servers speak to one another when the client in question is usually a web browser and the server in question is usually a web server. We've actually seen HTTP used already in, I think, lecture 1 or 2 when I demonstrated some of the software we've been using in my research, Wormboy, which used XML RPC, which even though it was an RPC mechanism implemented in XML, the transport layer being used was HTTP, though it could have been anything else, including SMTP or some homegrown protocol. But HTTP is commonly used as a nice transport mechanism, if only because it tends to sneak through firewalls if you operate it on certain ports, at least. So with that said, so far as we are concerned, HTTP allows a client to request data in any of two ways, though there are some, that's a simplification, the get method and the post method. So when a web browser requests information from a web server using HTTP get, what does that mean, so far as you know? It's requesting some information, but tell me something more that would make clear the distinction between get and post. And if you've never seen these details before, don't worry, that's the point of this discussion. Yeah, in the it spits out, the request is made essentially via the request string, via the URL itself. So if you've ever visited a website, which I'm sure you have, that has some URL, http://something, and then usually a question mark, and then something like foo equals bar, maybe you then have, wow, maybe you have an ampersand, which is baz equals quux, and so forth. This is an example of an HTTP GET request because pretty much all of the input provided by the user or the browser is passed in via the URL. In essence, that's what's going on. In fact, what's really happening, and we can see this as a quick demo, if we were, for instance, we'll pick a random web server and hope that it works, if we were to actually connect to, pick your favorite website. Google? All right, that was the easy part. All right, so Telnet, we're going to open up an HTTP request using Telnet. Telnet doesn't necessarily need to operate on port 23. It can operate on any port you want, so we can actually see it, see the session interactively. So I'm going to go to telnetgoogle.com, but on port 80, because I'm going to create the illusion of an HTTP request. We've connected to Google successfully, So we now have a TCP IP socket open. What I'm now going to do is manually craft the string that I want to get. And specifically, I want to get, quote unquote, the root of the web server, which is probably index.html or whatever the equivalent does, equivalent is, using HTTP 1.1. The convention is then to hit return twice, \n\n. And what do we get back? Well, clearly a whole bunch of HTML. And if we scroll up and we actually pass this through to a browser, what you would really see is Google's homepage. So what we've just received from Google is the hypertext that is to be transported. Let's take a look at the very top of this transmission and notice that as soon as I hit enter twice up here after get/HTTP 1.1, notice that the server responded with the following message. And this is the convention that the protocol dictates. It says, all right, I'm responding with this particular language, HTTP 1.1. A bunch of information in this case on cache control, on the type of content being returned. Here's the MIME type being returned by the server. That's determined usually by the file extension that's being returned by the Apache web server or whatever it is. And this is interesting. And we'll come back to this. There's this ability to set cookies. And even if you're not too familiar with using these, you've probably heard in one point or other that they're not so good. And that's kind of misleading because they're quite a useful and omnipresent mechanism these days. And then you see a bunch of other information there, including the date and then finally the actual content. So notice, though, that when I made this request, everything was passed in via the URL. There really was no request other than what I typed in at that line. In fact, let's go ahead and go to, just to see a difference, Yahoo. Let's search for all things related to movies. Notice that the URL string changed, and though it's small to see, we're essentially at search.yahoo.com/search?p=movies. And then some other stuff. Let's see if we can mimic this request, or at least part thereof, and get away with it. I'm going to copy part of it, the simplest part. I'm going to telnet to search.yahoo.com, port 80, enter. I'm going to say get. And now I'm pasting in not just slash, but an actual request with input parameters nested inside of it, namely p=movies. Then we'll say HTTP 1.1. And what we got back was, again, some form of HTML. Notice jumping out at us, if you just visually parse this, that was clearly a bad request, but that's probably because I didn't actually give Yahoo all of the requisite information. I just chopped out the p=movies. So just for kicks, we can try it once more, but I'll copy the whole string that was passed in. We'll go back here, reconnect, get that whole long string, HTTP 1.1, enter. And bad request. So there's yet more information going on there, which may in fact be related to a cookie or related to information that Yahoo actually sends you the first time, or it could be quite simply a function of the fact that when I first hit Yahoo, I actually was at www.yahoo.com, so the server might actually be checking what the referrer URL is, namely only allow the search if it's coming from www. These are just hypotheses, but clearly I'm losing information when I perform this, but in effect, some of the principles are still the same. The response I get is just of the same kind of form where we get back an HTTP response, but this time no such cookie information. Contrast this with, briefly, the notion of a post. So a get request in short is something passed in entirely in the URL, which is useful often if you want to see what's going on in the URL, if it's a short request, especially when our URL is just in a real-world sense. When are HTTP GET requests in a real-world sense quite useful as opposed to a POST request, which, for now, know that it means that the information is not embedded in the URL. It's sent transparently. Saving them as a favorite. So if you visit something like Craigslist a lot and you look up apartment listings for a certain zip code, or you visit Google a lot and you just want to keep searching every day for Google's top movie listings, or any kind of website where you perform some kind of query or click some link that passes in inputs to the server, well, if you don't use GET requests, it becomes difficult for people to bookmark that precise page or two to forward that URL to a friend. I mean, how many of you have ever received an email from someone, savvy or not, that they say, hey, check out this link, look at this article, you click on it, sorry, your session has expired, or sorry, this resource, I mean, it's stupid things like that that are ultimately a function of, one, get strings not having been sufficient, and two, session issues related to cookies, which we'll come back to last night. So I point this out now because as we begin to look at some of the servlet code in Java, you'll see that understanding the distinction between get and post can actually affect how your application behaves. So a post request does something different. The information is not passed in via the URL string, but how instead is it passed in? So it's actually passed in below. Okay, so let's in fact take a quick look at this. What we have among tonight's demos in our example 7 directory is a whole bunch of files, one of which is diagserver.java, and two of which are get.html and post.html. Notice that the contents of, and you should have printouts of these among your handouts tonight, notice that get.html is very simply... Wrong application. Notice that get.html is a very simple and incredibly ugly web page, but that demonstrates pretty much the types of input mechanisms you can use when developing web-based forms. So if you've never used web-based forms before, or rather, if you've never developed web-based software that uses web-based forms, here is your simplest and perhaps ugliest demonstration thereof. You've all used these kinds of things, right? You go to Google, you use an input field. You click submit, you're using a submit button. You've used all these mechanisms before. Starting with Project 3, you'll start deploying them in a GUI sense. Well, notice up top we have foo, which is an input field of type text. We below that have bar, which is of type radio, which is a radio button, which means it's exclusively 0 or 1 or neither in this case. Baz, which is going to be a checkbox. Quux, which is going to be a dropdown, which has a value of 0 or 1 as well. And then double quux, which is just a text area where you can actually hit enter and you can type multiple paragraphs and so forth. If we look briefly at the source for this, it's relatively simple. Notice that it pretty much fits on a screen full here. This is a web page written in XHTML. And notice that to implement a form, use the form element. And I'm going to go somewhat quickly here, lest this be dull if you're already familiar with it, but just try to highlight some of the salient features for our project purposes. When you have a form, you have an action. The action attribute specifies what, for those familiar? What server this form should be submitted to. So in effect, it's like an href, but a destination. So where is the information that you fill out in this form going to be sent? And then the method, finally, is either, for our purposes, get or post. If it's get, what does that mean is going to happen when I click the submit button, based on what we saw earlier? Yeah, everything you type in is going to show up in the URL. And there is a character limit on get strings, which is, it's quite large, I think. It's either 1,024 or 32,000, something like that, but there is a limit. Do you know the exact value? It's 2 kilobytes, so which is a lot, but the larger your applications get and the more pseudo-random strings you might be embedding as unique IDs, those bytes start to get eaten up pretty quickly. But with that said, the destination of this form is going to be apparently ice1.fas.harvard.edu and then :8080, which means port 8080 on that server. Well, what do we have? We have foo, which is an input type of text, and its name is foo. Bar, which is a radio type, whose name is bar, whose value can be 0 or whose value can be 1. Bear in mind, as we write XHTML, that you're going to be closing these elements as empty elements, lest you get invalid XHTML. Baz, meanwhile, is of type checkbox. Quux is of type select, which can have 0 or more options nested inside of it as such. And double quux is a text area, which simply looks like this. And only because I suspect many of you are familiar, that's the extent to which I think we'll introduce HTML forms, but we can spend more time on this in section or after class, if you'd like. The point for now is for me to pull up this web page, and what I'm going to do in a moment is fill out the form and then click submit so that this information is actually sent. But where is it being sent? What was the action field? ICE1. So notice, and for projects 3 and 4, this becomes more important, your prompt was changed with that CSCIE 259 setup program long ago to facilitate knowing what machine you are on. Though we talk about nice.fas.harvard.edu being a machine, it's actually just a moniker that refers to a cluster of machines. And if you haven't realized already, when you SSH to nice.fas.harvard.edu, you are in round robin or load balancing fashion sent to either ICE 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, maybe 5, however many they have running on a particular day. All of them look the same to you. They all have the same exact software, and via NFS, they all mount your home directory. So for all intents and purposes, it doesn't matter which one you're on until now. Because what I'm now going to do is I'm going to SSH specifically to ICE 1, at least for this demonstration, which is simple as typing SSH ICE 1. I'm going to log in again. I'm going to go into tonight's demonstrations. And what I'm going to run is Diag server, which is a Java class, which is a, if you ever wanted to see a web server written in Java, that's it. It's as simple as that, right? Java, they got everything except the kitchen sink in the Java library. So all you need to do is instantiate or extend a network server, which is in the sun.net package, and you got yourself a web server. So that's what we're using in order to have a little diagnostic program, which is going to run on port 8080. So when I hit enter, the effect is that I have just run on ice1.fas.harvard.edu a mini web server. And I already must have clicked submit at one point, unless there's someone in here with a laptop who just clicked submit. A little eerie example there. So hang on. No man behind the curtain this time. So we have the server running on port 8080. This is just a web server. Normally, if a web browser hit this, it would respond with a web page. Diag server I whipped up simply, and I think someone else whipped it up actually, simply prints to the screen what the browser's request was, essentially for diagnostic purposes. So, Roman, if you would like to fill out this form, give us some values, whatever will suffice, and go ahead and click submit. All right. Roman has just clicked submit by pulling up get.html. What Roman appears to have typed in is very little. So he chose a value of 1 for Quux, and I know that because look at the get string that the Internet Explorer or whatever he's using passed in. Actually, yep, he's using IE6. As we can see, that information too is passed in. So he specified 1 for Quux. He typed in QWERTY for double Quux. What did he type in for foo, bar, and baz? So foo has nothing. Bar and baz aren't even present, even though they're in the page. And this is one of those new, annoying little details that you need to bear in mind, especially when you're developing web applications that have HTML form inputs. The browser does not need to transmit the input type if it has a null value, which has serious ramifications if, for instance, you're implementing, for say, a portal, a mechanism via which you might want to allow a user to add feeds of news to their portal or remove feeds of news from their portal, and you want to use something like checkboxes, realize that when you start thinking on project 3, you can't simply iterate over all of the variables passed in from the client to the server to determine what the user wants to keep and what the user wants to get rid of necessarily. You often have to look on the server end as to what categories the user, what categories are even possible, because you cannot trust, in short, that the browser is going to send you all of the information back that you sent it. So even if you're not sure why that's even relevant or important, just tuck that away, because as you read through Project 3 spec and think about how to design your portal, that will become a potentially relevant detail. Let's go and ask Roman to go to post.html. And Roman, if you could type in slightly different values, just so that we know it's a different request, and click submit, notice that, in the meantime, the only thing different about get versus .html and post.html is, if we look at the source, 3 characters have been changed. Where it used to say method equals get, it now says, very small in this annoying little program, method equals post. That's the only difference. It is a copy-paste of the previous example. But when Roman clicks submit with post.html, notice what has changed. Pretty much all this metadata came in the same, for the most part. Notice what's different up here. It's as though he typed in nothing. But wait, if you look down below, notice that in a post request, everything is sent down here in what you might call the body of the request. The body of the request, meanwhile, has no maximum length because nested inside of the HTTP header this time is an additional field, content length, which allows Internet Explorer to say, all right, this request might have any number of bytes associated with it, but specifically there are 49. And the 49 starts counting from here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and all the way to the end. So it allows you to have an unbounded request, which is useful for particularly large requests. If you're uploading actual files, for instance, via POST, you can't upload most files via GET, right, in spirit. It just wouldn't really work. But when you have a mechanism like this, and it's not even necessarily POST, but you can imagine fitting an arbitrary amount of data here. Yeah. Is the content length specified in the protocol? Yeah, the browser figures out how much information it's passing in. Yes, I believe so, because I believe that's expected so that a receiving server can determine when to stop reading off of the socket in advance. There might be ways to hack around it. You can just assume if the socket closes, then you're done. But with HTTP 1.1, maintaining persistent connections, that might be non-trivial to do. So you want to know in advance how big the request is. Okay. So a lot of, yeah, question? Null should be a valid character, so you should be able to pass in raw zero values. Sure. Because, in fact, you can pass in essentially binary data if you really wanted to. Okay. So with that said, thank you, Roman, for that volunteering. And let's take a peek. So that's some of the underneath the hood, some of the details underneath the hood. Quick introduction to TCP ports. I chose 8080 before, and I chose 80. All right, what's the deal with 80? So, good. It is the default port for HTTP. So long story short, there are standards in this world that specify the default port for the protocol known as HTTP is 80. The default port for the protocol known as Telnet is 23. The default port for the protocol known as SSH is 22. The default port for FTP is 21, and so forth. There's a whole laundry list of these things. That just means by convention, that's where servers would typically operate those services. You can certainly override them and put it run protocols on any port. Typically, if you don't have root access to a computer, you cannot run services on the lower numbered ports. Usually the rule of thumb is if you don't have root on the machine, you can't use ports 0 through 1024, give or take, which is why typically in our examples we'll choose a port that's much higher but less than 65,536, that is like port 8080. So the only danger in this class subsequently is that if you happen to be on ICE-1 and someone else happens to be on ICE-1 and both of you choose the same port, you will very quickly get befuddled, potentially, if you wonder why you're visiting a web page, your portal, and it looks like some other guy's web portal. So bear in mind that I would not choose obvious numbers like 8080, choose a pseudo-random number off the top of your head, and just hope for the best. But you'll know when you try to spawn your server, you'll get an error if someone else is already using that port. So it won't be wholly unobvious. But TCP supports multiple ports, which is to say that a computer, a server, can run multiple services. You can have one box being an email server, a web server, a Gopher server, a Telnet server, any number of servers. Each of those services run, or those servers run on what are called different ports, so that clients can connect via TCP and even HTTP, whatever protocols, higher level up, but they can attach to that server multiple times. Now, essentially, you can run multiple services on one computer. So for our purposes, know that whereas web servers typically run on port 80, we'll run demos on 8080 or really some other random value. And that'll be relevant as you start to spawn your own servers. So we saw one of these operators earlier, the first one, set cookie. So among the things that HTTP supports is this notion of cookies. What is a cookie as far as you understand it in layman's terms? Okay, it's a string. Well, I would argue that most laymen don't know what we mean by string. So what? It's a value stored in the client machine. Sure. So in more real terms, it's often a little file placed on a user's computer by a web server. Or it's a value, a random number, placed in a user's RAM by a server. So you can have session cookies, as they're called, which are transient and pretty much live just in RAM, or you can have persistent cookies, which would actually get written to disk. So if you go poking around on your computer, if it's a PC, and like C, documents and settings, mail-in slash cookies, you'll see all the persistent cookies that sites like CNN or Google might have stored on your local computer. Okay, the world seems to think that cookies are dangerous and bad. Why? Yeah. Sure. Typically not good practice to let anyone write anything to your hard drive. Why else? They can pass ASCII characters, but by definition, browsers should not be executing any of those bytes. They should be read, never executed. So other people can see what you've been browsing. So in theory, that should not be possible if cookies are implemented correctly. However, you have quite a number of sites these days like DoubleClick. I know I'm not supposed to say this because a friend of mine works for DoubleClick. But DoubleClick is one of the largest ad-oriented companies. And DoubleClick will sell banner ads. She tells me all the time. They do other stuff now. But they sell banner ads for websites like, for the sake of discussion, CNN.com and maybe MSNBC.com. Now, if you have a third party providing ads to a website, well, how are those ads being integrated into, say, CNN's webpage? Well, usually it's as simple as having an image tag in CNN's web page with a source tag that says something like HTTP doubleclick.com and for simplicity add.gif. Right? That's pretty much what a lot of these websites do. They don't copy the ads to their local machine. After all, it's the job of DoubleClick to rotate these banners and so forth, so they simply embed in CNN's web page, in MSNBC's web page, just image tags like that that reference not CNN or MSNBC's own source directory, but rather DoubleClick's or whoever's. Well, it turns out that any time you open an HTTP connection to a web server, which this would induce, that web server can reply with its own HTTP header. And in that header can be what? Set cookie. So essentially, any time you open an HTTP connection to a web server, that web server can reply with a cookie of its own, and the image, but a cookie of its own, which by default a browser would typically then tuck away in memory or even on disk, depending on the type of cookie. Now, if DoubleClick is selling ads on CNN.com, and DoubleClick is selling ads on MSNBC, it turns out that MSNBC can't necessarily figure out that you just visited CNN, their competitor, and vice versa. But DoubleClick might be able to know that you visited CNN and MSNBC. And this kind of correlated information can prove valuable at times as you begin to gather a profile on people. The question for our purposes, though, is how is that? Well, essentially, anytime you visit a website, foo.com, if your browser has previously saved in RAM or on disk a cookie for foo.com, it is transmitted by default with your request. So when we saw Roman's requests earlier, he was not transmitting a cookie in either of these requests because he had just pulled up that web page for the very first time and I hadn't had time to push a cookie to him. But had my Diag server pushed a cookie back to him and then he hit refresh, assuming I coded it up correctly, his browser, perhaps unbeknownst to him, would reply not only with all of the fields that he inputted, but also with that cookie. And typically a cookie is nothing more than a large random number. A large random number that the server uses to uniquely identify that person. So even though I might not be able to know that it's Roman that visited my website, I do know that it's the same guy every time he hits refresh. Or the next day, if it's a persistent cookie, I know it's the same guy. Even if what changes from day to day? The IP address, right? Cookies were a mechanism that to some extent were a useful workaround for a world of DHCP and dynamic IP addresses which might change day to day. In real terms, they tend not to, but dial-up days and so forth, IP addresses would change often, so you can't just look at the guy's address and know that it's the same person, especially in this world of NAT, where you share one IP address among a dozen, two computers, 100 computers, you know that it's the same network visiting you, but not necessarily the same person. But if Roman is reminding me with every request, hey, I'm user 1234, hey, I'm user 1234, even if he's requesting different data, I know it's the same guy requesting the information. I saw a hand go up. Yeah?
I have a question. So, conceivably, you could, instead of leading with a cookie, be more insidious and actually change the value so that even so they think that they're getting it from some random person?
Good question. So can you spoof cookies? So if the browser is implemented correctly, it should only be delivering DoubleClick's cookies back to DoubleClick.com to the domain for which they were defined as valid. There have been instances, though, over the past few years of, I think, Netscape and IE not behaving correctly and other websites being able to access other websites' cookies. But that is an error in implementation, not in the protocol. So in theory, cookies are perfectly secure, and the fact that DoubleClick can track you is perfectly consistent with the specification. But this is why these days, and this is the only tweak I tend to make so far as security goes with IE, if you go to Privacy in Internet Explorer, go to Advanced, you'll see that you can override automatic cookie handling, and what it means to check block third-party cookies, as I have on the right-hand side, means precisely that. Let CNN is allowed to put cookies on my machine. MSN can put cookies on my machine because I say accept first-party cookies. But my computer rejects third-party cookies, where third-party is defined as being any cookie that's sent to you from a domain other than the one you yourself visited. So frankly, I turn that off because it does block that kind of tracking, and it's trivial enough to turn on. Yeah?
But then you can think of a situation, right, where DoubleClick.com and the site you're visiting, although the domain is different, it's actually owned by the same company, so even though you're, right, so...
True. So if you had cookies coming from multiple domains owned by the same party, sure. But that, too, is a reality. That is consistent with the protocol. Right, if CNN.com and MSNBC.com merge as corporate entities, well, then sure, they can correlate data together because they own both of the servers. Yeah?
So the tracking is only possible as long as that same cookie is on your machine?
Correct. So Roman could be flushing his cookies folder every night, or you could be running software that doesn't let them get saved there altogether. Typically these days, so many websites rely on cookies that disabling them altogether tends to break websites, which makes them more useful than dangerous, I think, typically. But there are ways around this. Just so you realize, cookies are typically sent via behind the scenes like that. In the event that cookies are disabled on a computer, servers do have ways of getting around that restriction and still remembering, if transiently, who you are. But we'll come back to that in a second. But let's put the question of the day on the table. Why are cookies relevant to us if our plan here on out is to be developing web-based applications? I mean, we don't care about, you know, peppering our portals with ads for our course purposes, so where's their value? You don't necessarily want a user to log in every time, so using cookies, you can remember that, oh, user 1234 just authenticated 5 minutes ago. Let's just let him in. The danger, of course, is what? If it's a public computer, if, you know, Roman starts passing his laptop around, or he's sitting at a lab computer in which other users can sit down without the cookies being flushed, someone else might still have access to a live cookie or a live session, as we'd say, so someone else could pull up his Gmail account. For instance, if it checks only the cookie and doesn't require subsequent authentication. What else? You might have a customer who's in the middle of a transaction and okay, so when the user, if it's a persistent cookie and the user closed the window, he might have wanted to end the session and thereby get rid of that information, but cookies might keep it around, especially if it's persistent. Yeah?
If somebody else can guess the value of the cookie that's on your machine, he might be able to pretend to be you.
Correct. Theoretically, if you transmitted to a server a forged cookie, just guessed a random number, I believe most servers should be smart enough to check that at least that same value is in fact, well, No, that would work. I believe that's consistent with the spec. If you did guess the same pseudo-random number, however many digits it is, and that depends on how big a cookie you want to put on the server, you theoretically could spoof someone else's connection. Sure, absolutely. So if you're sniffing wireless traffic or even wired traffic on a hub, you could grab this information. One workaround, not to that latter problem, but to the former, where you're worried about someone spoofing your cookie, I retract that. I mean, there are dangers in doing this. The fact of the matter is, though, especially if you're using large enough values, we're talking pretty infinitesimal probabilities of guessing someone else's cookie. Moreover, knowing what, being able to then make use of that is non-trivial, but possible, as it is the case with most of these transactions. But let's come back to that, because you can mitigate those concerns to some extent with SSL and actually encrypting the whole transmission and so forth so that it becomes somewhat less of an issue. But with that said, we will come back to a demonstration here. I introduce it just as a mechanism we'll eventually play with, which is it's a proxy, essentially a sort of packet sniffer that we will interpose when we get to web services so that we can actually see some more of this HTTP traffic going back and forth. But in that context, it will be with regard to RPC-type calls as opposed to just simple HTTP requests. For now, let's get a bit of jargon out of the way and then take a look at some actual use of cookies and HTTP as it relates to J2EE and servlets and JSP. So here's a lot of buzzwords and big terms that at the end of the day describe fairly simple concepts. So if you have a two-tier application, that typically means you've got a very canonical structure, a client and a server, each of which is communicating with each other. The client tier, sort of straightforward. Let's move on to something slightly more interesting. So when you have a situation of where n equals 3, so we're talking about n-tier enterprise applications, which is simply to say that in the interests of scalability, in the interests of redundancy, in the interests of maintenance, you sometimes want to segment out different services so that you're not just running your email, your web, your Gopher, your Telnet, your SSH servers all on the same box, but rather you are partitioning them among multiple boxes, sometimes redundantly so. And we'll see, moreover, even when you're running applications, it's often useful to be able to factor out things like your database service and your presentation layer service, like the rendering of XSLT and so forth, into disparate components. So in this case, we have what we might describe as a three-tier environment in which we have a browser making requests to a web server, which would be, in our previous example, the server tier. But in this case, the server, the web server, actually delegates authority for dealing with email to like an email server. A very typical approach. You know, Hotmail, Gmail, all of these are not single boxes doing everything. They all have particular tasks dedicated to them. If you have n equals 5, which is similarly fairly representative, you might have a browser communicating, with a web server, something like Apache or IIS. But behind the scenes, actually implementing some logic, processing user input, and not just dishing out static or dynamic content is an application server. And it's in this application server that, starting tonight, we'll begin to dabble with XML, with Java, with XSLT, and eventually more. But in turn, you might have that application server dishing off responsibility for emails to an email server, and that email server, in turn, might be interacting with some database server to actually get the addresses to which to send content, and so forth. Again, an arbitrary example, but demonstrates that even you can quite easily imagine what different services could be hosted elsewhere, and via simple method calls or some kinds of hooks you're imposing, these things can all communicate together. So XML, as it relates to this tiering of applications. So in the beginning, one of the most touted uses for XML was for display of data, was really on the client tier, because consider, after all, the nuisance that it's become developing web-based applications where you have different clients. Even if those clients are Netscape versus Internet Explorer, already today you have those kinds of browsers rendering information differently. CSS, to some extent, has started to mitigate that. If you push XSLT and XML to a browser, even if hopefully those, the vision was, for instance, you could push not XHTML or HTML content out to a browser, but you could just ship it the data. And maybe you could ship it a style sheet as well. Maybe that style sheet could be cached for subsequent transformations. But in short, you could push the content to the client and then start to use the thousands of spare cycles that most clients have to do a lot of the processing that servers have long done. Unfortunately, you find that this tends not to work great, right? Especially in a world in which folks can't even agree on how HTML can be rendered. It simply has not proved such an explosive feature that you could render, for instance, XSLT and XML client-side. After all, even though you were playing with that for Project 2, doing some of your client-side development, that's not really how it works these days. 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, such code is being rendered on the server side and then pushed out to the client. But today, you actually see XML not necessarily in the client tier, but in these server tier, or in any number of these back-end tiers, as we've posited. Well, in the client, we'll wave our hands at this, as it's all fairly redundant based on what we just said. But looking at XML on the server, or middle tier, it's long been the case that you have, in any sort of segmented framework, when you have a middle tier communicating with a back-end tier and eventually communicating with a client tier, you've always had these mechanisms for making intra-procedure calls, remote procedure calls, COM, DCOM, EJBs, CORBA. There have been solutions for hooking applications together in the middle for a long time. What we introduce now, though, is the potential for using XML as a means of hooking these applications together. And recall, after all, that one of the first things we looked at, I think, in lecture one was this notion of hooking disparate systems together using XML. Well, in what form does this come? Well, in our first demonstration in lecture one, we did that simple research-based WormBoy example where we had a client and a server communicating ultimately via this open standard, which in that case was XML RPC. There was no reason that I had to use XML RPC to do that, right? I could have written my own homegrown protocol. I could have used any number of protocols that have long existed. But one of the upsides of XML that we touted early on in the course was what? Give me anything.
Readable.
Okay, it's readable, which, again, the more you use it, the more I at least begin to appreciate the value of actually having something human readable, even just during development of it. What else? It's standardized, so it too is standardized. It's not proprietary, and that by committing to it, you're not committing to a particular vendor's products or a particular language, per se. I mean, XML RPC, after all, in my own example, was implemented in C on one end, Java on the other end, and it could have been implemented in any other number of languages because it really was platform neutral. And there were 10 other, or, you know, there were 10 and more design objectives that we threw on the screen long ago, some of which are of questionable value. The verbosity is certainly something that works against us, I think, in many cases. When, after all, even for my own application, I'm sending MendyB 20 integers, and yet my file is this big, because I have more metadata going across the wire than actual data, but it's a trade-off. And you can certainly mitigate that in other ways. XML on the back end here, not just hooking applications together, but might be used to actually store information. Becoming increasingly popular, certainly discussed, are things like XML databases, which in effect are very similar in spirit to object-oriented databases, which have long existed, but they allow you to, with languages like XQuery, which we'll look at next week, allow you to model your data as something hierarchical, as objects in effect, but XML objects that you can query against using XPath-like expressions and not have to deal with trying to cram or convert the notion of entities that have some hierarchical structure in your own code to something that's very flat and relational or table-based, which is often the case for very optimized databases. So in short, a typical J2EE architecture might be the following, where at the top level here in the picture, we have what we'd call the client tier. So you got your laptops, your desktops, your PDAs, whatever it is that ultimately defines the client end. You might have in the middle tier the presentation layer. These are simply your servers or your code that ultimately handles the rendering of information. Nothing magical here, but the transformation of XSLT on XML to XHTML, or the rendering of JSP to XHTML, or PHP, if we wanted to take it out of the domain of J2EE, that sort of layer. In the back end, you might have what you'd describe as business logic, where you have EJBs, Enterprise Java Beans, or other types of back-end logical mechanisms that are actually doing number crunching or actually fetching data and then passing that data in the form of objects to your presentation layer, which can then be rendered by the servlets or JSPs. And then in the back-end, you might have what you dub the data tier, where it's your back-end database services or whatnot. The point, though, being is that for our purposes tonight, we ask the question, or in projects 3 and 4, we'll ask the questions, where is it appropriate to put XML, right? XML is not the solution to all problems. There's often a trade-off when deploying it. Sometimes you get greater ease of use, but you pay for it in terms of performance or in size. But we'll ask questions like, is it appropriate for these two layers to communicate via XML? Is it appropriate to use XML in the presentation layer, going from XML through XSLT to XHTML? Is it appropriate on the client end to transmit that data back out as XML? And these are the sort of question marks that are on the table for now. What I think we will do is go ahead and let's take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, we will spend our time on demos galore. Here we go, the juicy stuff, the actual use of some of these ideas. Java server pages and Java servlets are two of the primary components of what's generally known as J2EE. So Java 2 Enterprise Edition is not only Java 2 Standard Edition, which is all the stuff you've been used to when you actually implement Java code, all of those libraries, but it's a whole bunch of other libraries, a whole bunch of other stuff that's related to enterprise-type applications, namely server-side applications. So for the most part, it's a buzzword, and what we will be doing over the next several weeks is drawing components of J2EE into the applications and the demonstrations that we do. Realize that on Sun's webpage, you can download both the SDK for J2SE, which you already did for the course, or J2EE. We don't bother having you download J2EE ever because we simply download individually those components of it that we want to integrate into our applications, because it isn't necessarily Sun Microsystems implementations that we'll necessarily use, but others' implementations of various APIs that do in fact exist in J2EE. So with that said, this is perhaps the only time that I'm going to put up these rather verbose definitions, only because they fairly well communicate what these simple things are, even in the absence of examples. So JSP, aka Java Server Pages, is a technology for building applications for generating dynamic web content, such as HTML, DHTML, XHTML, and XML. JSP enables the easy authoring of web pages that create dynamic content with maximum power and flexibility, right? Can't wait to get your hands on something like that, right? Those of you familiar with PHP, though, will find it very reminiscent of a language like PHP, and even in a sense, but not nearly as close to something like XSLT, in which you can output dynamically HTML and also access values from an XML document dynamically. Similar in spirit, but I would say that PHP is closer. What is a JSP page? Well, in English, it is a text document that describes how to create a response object from a request object for a given protocol. The processing of the JSP page may involve creating and or using other objects. HTTP is the default protocol for requests and responses. Additional request response protocols may be supported by JSP containers. The default request and response objects are of type HTTP servlet request and HTTP servlet response. And we'll see those in just a moment, those two teletype font words. So here's an example, your first JSP that thoroughly fails to communicate any of those features that we just enumerated, but gives you a working example of JSP. So here is a file, we could call it hello.jsp, that quite simply, when executed in a server that supports JSPs, will render this as what? Hello world. So the takeaway for this slide is that anytime you have logic nested inside of this page, you use open bracket percent sign, then you write what in effect is Java code, and then you close it with a percent sign and an angled bracket. So this is similar in structure to what we've done with XSLT, where notice that anything that doesn't begin with open bracket percent is just going to be outputted as raw data. So one of the things JSPs allows you to do is just very off the top of your head write the HTML that you want to generate. But when you want to incorporate some data dynamically or employ some logic dynamically, you can simply whip out some of these JSP tags and write some actual logic inside of them, some actual Java code. There is an alternative approach to implementing JSP that is much less common, know that it exists, which is to use these explicit JSP scriptlet tags, and I offer them because it makes more clear, perhaps, particularly in light of our discussion of namespaces and our use of XSLT, how you might write JSP in a very similar approach to what we've done with, say, XSLT. But I don't think you'll find this as common, if only because it's much more verbose, and things start to get uglier more quickly. But know that it exists. Okay, yes?
That last example looks like it would parse as an XML
document. This, in fact, would, yes. So when you're using JSP scriptlet tags, as they're called, and an effect is rendered or parsed as XML. Okay, servlets, just to round things off, because you'll find that there's this inherent relationship between servlets and JSPs. So a servlet, the buzzword, say, is a Java technology-based web component managed by a container that generates dynamic content. Like other Java-based components, servlets are platform-independent Java classes that are compiled to platform-neutral bytecode that can be loaded dynamically into and run by a Java technology-enabled web server. So in more real terms, whereas a JSP is literally a file called index.jsp that might have a whole bunch of HTML in it and then some dynamically generated content by way of those JSP tags, open bracket, percent sign, a servlet is actually a index.java class or a foo.java class that exists elsewhere in your web server or your application server, really, that gets invoked when the user visits a certain URL, but it itself does not really tend to contain any HTML. Rather, its job is entirely to take some input, maybe some variables that the user provided via a web page like our examples earlier, like this, to perform some processing, to wrap those up in what's called a response object, and then pass that response object off to, for instance, an actual JSP, which could then access those pieces of data dynamically, or it could be passed off to an XSLT style sheet. If you were to tuck things up in some XML fragment, you could pass it to a style sheet and then let something like Xalin do the final processing in the so-called presentation layer. A servlet container, which is a word we saw a moment ago, is simply like a server that knows how to process JSPs and servlets. Servlet container is a specific instance of what would be more generally known as an application server. So container, server, a servlet container, runs alongside of or inside of a web server. So you could have Apache, which is your popular off-the-shelf web server product, being attached via some hooks, you know, certain configuration files, to a servlet container, so that if a user visits your website and requests index.html, well, that's just static content. So Apache would just spit back the response when requested. But if the request came in for index.jsp, well, the web server could pass that request along to the servlet container, and servlet containers do also support JSPs in effect. The backend servlet container or application server could do the processing, pass the resulting bytes back to the web server, and then the web server can deal with getting them back to the user. Most of this implementation is transparent to the developer, and it's all handled by way of configuration files that you set up once. And then when you spawn your server, everything works transparently to you, the developer. The only thing affected is where you put certain files, as we'll see with some canonical examples. What is a servlet container? Well, the one that we will make use of, which is a fairly robust and ever so popular, increasingly so, servlet container, is Apache's Tomcat product, freely available, scales incredibly well. You do see commercial applications being run off of even this free product. Other implementations, perhaps more commercialistic, are BEA's WebLogic server, IBM's WebSphere, you have JBoss, Oracle has their own application server, Sun has its own, and there are others out there as well. The nice thing about Tomcat is, one, it does scale well, and it's not infeasible to consider using it in your own production environment, even subsequent to this class, but it's also very easily managed and easily downloaded and set up, literally within a matter of minutes to get it up and running. And what it does, too, is it not only is a servlet container, an application server for JSPs and servlets and so forth, it also comes with its own embedded web server, which means you don't even have to deal with all of these hooks and so forth. You just run it, and then you've got everything all in one package, a web server for static content and GIFs and JPEGs, but also a servlet container that runs your servlets, JSPs, and so forth. So what does this all mean? How does it all fit together? Here is the typical sequence of events that we will see in tonight's demos and pretty much throughout projects 3 and 4. So a client in step 1, your web browser, accesses a server and makes an HTTP request, not unlike the sample ones we've seen earlier tonight. That request is received by a web server, and if it's for a servlet or a JSP, it's handed off to the servlet container. That servlet can be running in the same machine, the same process as the web server, as is the case with Tomcat, or it can be a separate machine or process altogether, somehow hooked together by uninteresting configuration files. Step 3, the servlet container determines what servlet to pass this HTTP request to. So recall earlier we gave names to these things, HTTP servlet request and HTTP servlet response. Think of that, in effect, as a Java object wrapped around stuff like this. In fact, a little more than that, stuff like including the actual data from the user. Think of this stuff as being automatically wrapped up in a Java object and being called an HTTP servlet request. So in our story here in step 3, it's that Java object containing that information that's handed off to the appropriate servlet, which you would implement as, again, a Java class, foo.java, bar.java. Each of those could be disparate servlets. The servlet in question uses that response object to figure out who the remote user is. What do we mean by this? Think cookies. Embedded in that object is going to be whatever cookie information was passed in, what post parameters were sent in, if relevant, and what data was passed in, namely what's the value of foo, what's the value of bar, baz, quux, double quux, and so forth. The servlet performs whatever logic it was programmed with, you know, do whatever it is you're supposed to do with this, you know, buy me a book with this information, return results on movies to me with this information, whatever the request was geared around, and then the servlet sends that data back to the client via what's called a response object. And that, in effect, is a Java object that contains whatever the resulting output is of the servlet, plus, in effect, whatever is relevant to be sent back in the HTTP headers. But most of that is handled for you transparently, as you'll see. Finally, step 5, once the servlet's all done with that, the container ensures that the response is actually sent out and says, hey, web server, it's up to you now. My job is done. So in effect, the servlet container never really interacts directly with the user. You have this tier in the middle being the web server, which might be the same product, the same software, but conceptually, it's a separate point person. It's a middleman between client and middle tier or back-end tier. So here come the examples. In tonight's code excerpts, you have in example 7 a few other files. So HTTP CGI, if for those of you who want to play around at home, this is a CGI implementation essentially of the same Diag server idea, but I think it's written in Perl, the CGI version. That leaves us with then this base directory. In this base directory, and you have printouts of some of the files herein, but this is the sort of thing that's easier if you CD around the directory yourself on your own machine or on NICE later, we have three directories. Let's move it down here. Three directories. This is a structure that's going to be incredibly similar to what you see in projects 3 and 4, and it's incredibly similar to what many web application environments would look like. In other words, what we've tried to do with projects 3 and 4, and even this demonstration, is really present to you zip files and tarballs of applications that are literally going to be deployed on NICE as you would deploy them on your own production machines, on your own computer, on your own Linux box. Pretty representative. And in fact, all of the configuration files we use are simply simplified default standard configuration files from Tomcat. So what I'm going to do in a moment is run Tomcat, which again is this application slash web server, and I'm going to run it from this directory. As you might guess, the web applications that Tomcat is going to then run for me is whatever's in this directory. Tomcat's going to be configured by this conf directory, and in this temp directory is just where Tomcat by default plop some stuff when it's actually running. And the reason I include it in projects 3 and 4 and in this demo is Tomcat tends to complain if it doesn't already exist. So it's a silly little detail. There should be nothing in it right now. So with that said, let's take a quick look at some of the files that are relevant to you, the sysadmin and the developer, since you'll play both roles for the purposes of the course. In the conf directory, there's server.xml, tomcatusers.xml, and web.xml. Tomcatusers.xml, for the purposes of this course, you'll never have to change. It is simply a copy of a standard tomcatusers.xml file that ships with Tomcat. Essentially, it has to do with configuration options that can, for the most part, be left alone. With that said, I would defer to online documentation for specifics. It's a fairly small file. Web.xml, meanwhile, has a lot of default definitions that control the behavior of the server. We will override some of those settings with an application-specific web.xml, which I'll actually show you. But what you will need to look at for this demo and for projects 3 and 4 is server.xml, which essentially is the high-level configuration file for Tomcat. This is a copy of a standard Tomcat configuration file, and what I've tried to do is rip out of it any distractions, any features that are going to be turned off anyway, any features that aren't useful for a first run at an application, so that you can really hone in on types of settings that you at home for a final project, for a work-related project, might actually care about yourself. What you need to know for using Tomcat is that there are two ports you need to configure, which I usually leave blank so that all of you are not running on port 8080, and it just creates headaches for us. So what I have chosen up here is to run the server on port 8000, but that's actually only part of the server, essentially for diagnostic commands or a back-end channel. The port element that you'll need to change for projects 3 and 4 is lower in the file, and the comments in this file and the project spec tell you where to look for these things, but notice there is port 8080. Notice that in this connector element, which again is just the configuration for Tomcat, I've essentially specified some fairly self-explanatory features. The maximum number of threads that Tomcat will support will be 150, which is the default value. That means realistically, theoretically, the server could handle all 150 incoming connections at once. After that point, they would get queued up, or the connection would stall until one of those threads was available. Min spare threads, this is how many threads Tomcat's going to try to keep available, a pool of resources essentially. Connection timeout, how long it takes before a connection will just time out if nothing's actually happening. And then a few other options are later in the file as well. The only one you'll need to change for this course's purposes, for the projects, are those two port values, and the spec tells you to do so. The relevance is that when you run Tomcat, it is going to look at that file and run the server on that port. So there's a bunch of diagnostic information here, but notice that one of the interesting lines is this third to last, starting Coyote, which is just the web server that ships here. HTTP 1.1 is supported on HTTP. That's the protocol being used, 8080. So that's the port on which the server is running. Notice now that I'm on ICE1, and that's why that's relevant. Take note of the host that you're on, because you cannot go to HTTP. You cannot go to HTTP nice.fas ever for this course's projects and demos. It doesn't exist. It is not a machine. If you are running your server on ICE1 port 8080, that means it's not running on ICE2 port 8080, which means if you're randomly assigned to the wrong machine, you're going to be scratching your head as to why it's taking so long for your server to spawn. You want to go instead to ICE1, in this case, .fas.harvard.edu. The means by which you specify a port is colon 8080. Realize that you'll often want to say HTTP colon slash slash because IE, at least, I believe, tends to get confused if you include a colon but you don't specify the protocol. It doesn't guess sometimes that you want HTTP, if I recall correctly. I hit enter, and look what I get, a directory listing. Notice that this is not the same directory listing that you're used to on nice.fast. If we go into tonight's own lecture examples, notice that this is what the directory listing usually looks like on nice. Notice the aesthetic difference. That's because this web server is not run by FAS Computer Services. This is being run by me at the prompt. If I kill this with Control C and get back my prompt, and now I hit refresh, nothing will happen. Eventually, this connection attempt will time. What a horrible demo. Nothing should have happened because that server is not actually alive. Perhaps it'll work this time. So it's not going to connect because the server has been killed and is no longer running on that port. If, however, I, in the background, go ahead and respawn Tomcat quickly enough before IE times out, let's see if it'll recover. Depends on the timeout mechanism. So it is running now. IE timed out too soon, but I hit refresh, now it works. So it's back alive. So that's the mechanics of what we're doing here. Now notice we have four files in the root of this directory, and yet they're not there. Well, because of the configuration file down below, there was also this element, the host, where I essentially define a virtual host in the same spirit as Apache supports, if you're familiar. Notice that what I've done is I've specified that on the local host, the base for my applications is in a directory called web apps. That we've seen before. Specifically, we want to, and these are some other options which we don't need to spend much time on for now, but specifically the base for my applications is going to be in web apps. Notice then below that is a child element called context, and specifically the base directory in which all of my actual documents are in with respect to web apps is called by convention root, all uppercase. Well, let's see what's actually in there. If I take a look in web apps, notice that I've got one directory, root. If I go into the root directory, notice what I've got, five different things, four JSPs, and then one web-inf directory, which is also named that way by convention. If I go into that web-inf directory, notice that I've got two things, a classes directory and a web.xml. This is the config file that I said earlier will override some of those default settings. In classes, meanwhile, are three classes, both the bytecodes and the source for them. Those are the first three servlets we're going to look at, and these are the first four JSPs that we will look at. The command that I keep typing to run Tomcat is Tomcat. What is that on NICE? Well, as you'll see in Project 3 spec, it's actually alias to a command called catalina.sh, which ships with Tomcat. So it's just an alias to this command. And the Project 3 spec will walk you through the same aliasing effect. So I don't have to type that whole string every time I want to run Tomcat. What Tomcat is configured to do is look in your current working directory for its base. And by base, I mean the directory in which its conf directory, web apps directory, and temp directory are assumed to exist. So if you run it in the wrong directory, for instance, web apps, bad things happen, right? And that's sort of enough said there. But if we go back to the base directory, run Tomcat, we get our useful diagnostic messages, and it is actually started up now. So let's look at our first JSP. Well, our first JSP file is this file called let's choose where is it? Hello one. Hello1.jsp. Right there was our impressive demonstration from earlier. So does it actually work? Well, so long as Tomcat is running, I'm going to click on hello1.jsp, and it does in fact appear to work. No magic there. Realize though, just to make the distinction clear, if you go into nice.fas, into the index via the course website, and go into the same directory, web apps, root, hello1.jsp, you get this. This is because the web server, namely Apache, running on nice.fas.harvard.edu, does not know what a .jsp file is. There is not running on nice.fas a application server that supports JSPs and servlets, hence the error message. You have the wrong server trying to view the file. Here you have the right server, your server, trying to view the file. So let's take a look at Hello 2. Not surprisingly, it too works. So that's just to demonstrate that the server's actually working. One of the files we include in each of the projects, as well as tonight, is this little script called happyenv, happyenvironment.jsp, which is a way of looking via your browser at what your server settings are. So you're familiar probably with environment check, which is that little command we put on NICE so that you can see what your environment looks like. This is your web-based way of checking that you've actually set up your account correctly or your own machine correctly, because you can look at the versions of Xerxes and Xalin and so forth installed on your server, for your server. Notice that I've upgraded, as of tonight, Xerxes on NICE to 2.8, which fixes a number of bugs that you may or may not have stumbled across. Xalin is left alone, but Ant is as we expect. JDK is as we expect, and so forth. So that's a way of diagnosing your server. But we haven't really looked at any servlets yet. We're going to focus for Project 3 mostly on servlets with a tinge of JSP integrated. Project 4 will use slightly more JSP, but yet we don't seem to have any way of accessing the servlets, right? We seem to have bottomed out. We're in the root of the directory, but there's nothing actually there. Where were those servlets? There were three of them. They were in that classes directory and that web INF directory. And this is sort of a Tomcat or an application standard. There are other servlet containers that take the same approach. Well, let's take a quick look in the web INF directory at web.xml. This is a very canonical configuration file for a servlet container, be it Tomcat or Geronimo or a few others. You have this file. It's XML-based, so I was harping for a while on the utility of XML for config files alone. You see them all throughout J2EE-related software. Notice that we have a web app root element. Associated with this web app are three servlets. And I say that because I see three servlet elements. Each servlet is defined by a name and a class. What I seem to be saying up here in the line that I've highlighted is that the servlet called hello is going to be mapped to a class called hello.java or hello.class specifically. A servlet called parameters is going to be mapped to a class called parameters.java, parameters.class. Same thing for visits. So this is the means by which I'm essentially mapping named servlets to their actual implementations. And by convention, all such servlets end up going in the webinf directory /classes. And this is true in Tomcat and in other servlet containers as well. That's typically the convention. So what does this mean? Well, this means if I actually visit a seemingly invisible servlet directory slash hello, and then let's actually take a look at this first. In classes, hello.java, let's see what this file is. Notice that it's fairly short. So our first servlet is fairly short. Notice that we are going to print HTML, but that's because this is a simple demonstration. But notice that most of the work of implementing a servlet comes from simply extending one someone else wrote, the default one that ships with the servlet API, Java Servlet 2.4. Just extend HTTP servlet, and if you want to support GET requests, the method that you need to override is called doGET. Its signature is as above, and it takes, as we promised earlier, a request and a response. Notice that here's how I'm going to reply. I'm going to output XHTML, so I'm going to set the response object's content type to the MIME type known as text/HTML. Here, I have a bit of Java code because associated with an HTTP servlet response is a writer. You've used print writers before in Java to print things to standard out. Well, tucked up inside a response object is such a writer, so this is the means by which you get the equivalent of system.out, but with respect to an HTTP response. And then all this stuff is just boring print lines. I'm just printing, not in an elegant fashion. Outputting HTML with print lines is not a recommended approach, but it's our first servlet. It's meant to be simple. So what happens when I run this? Well, if I go back over to my directory, servlet slash hello, enter, hello world. That was generated by the servlet. How was it generated? Well, it'd be redundant to retell this story, but that's what just happened. Let's take a look at a slightly more interesting servlet. In this classes directory, we have parameters and visits. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at parameters.java. This too extends HTTP servlet. sets the content type, grabs that writer, and let's take a look at what it does. Well, here is a very simple servlet that shows you how to get access to any of the HTML inputs that are provided by the user. We're going to use a Java enumeration and call it params, and then inside this request object is a method called getParameterNames. So I'm just going to get an enumeration, like a linked list or an array, effectively, of all the parameter names, which in the case of post and get.html were foo, var, vas, quux, double quux. And what I'm going to do is iterate over them, and all I'm going to do in this servlet is just print out what the names and values were. Notice that I'm not outputting HTML. I'm doing text plain this time. So the browser will just display it as plain text. So let's see what this thing does. If I go to servlet slash parameters, enter, sort of boring. What can I do? All right, so I could put in parameters myself by just writing the get string myself, question mark, which was our approach earlier. Let's say foo equals David and bar equals Malin. Enter. Now we see that the servlet is parsing those requests. If you wanted to even snazzier example, we could very quickly go to the copy of get.html on my desktop, quickly edit its source to map it to, we're on ICE1 still, .fas, we're on port 80, but I want to send the action line this time to servlet parameters. I'm going to save that file. I'm going to open it in IE on my local machine. I'm going to say Roman for foo. One, I'm going to check this thing, set this to one, and write, hello, Roman. Submit that get request. And notice where I am. I've gone from my local machine to ice1.fas, and all those parameters have been parsed. And here, too, notice what values are passed by a browser. When you use a checkbox, you don't get one or zero. You get, quote, unquote, on or nothing at all. In fact, if we do it again without this checked, and with this maybe set to zero, submit the get request, notice what disappeared. The checkbox. So you don't even get off, you just get nothing. And bear that in mind when you're implementing GUIs that you're trying to determine was that checkbox on or off, you don't check if it was on or off. You check if it was on. Otherwise, it was off, if not on. Well, there's one more servlet we have here. It too is simple, but it illustrates some basic ideas. In visits.java, you see our first use of something called a session, right? We spent all that time earlier tonight on this notion of cookies. Well, what the heck was the point of a cookie, fundamentally?
To remember
that a user is the same user as before. HTTP is a stateless protocol, which means when you, in effect, hit enter and pull up a page, that's it. The connection closes. Small white lie with HTTP 1.1 for lots of the connections, but for the most part, you hit enter, IE comes back with the result, you're done. The web server is done dealing with you until you initiate a new connection. Well, this is problematic if you want to maintain information on the server, like who this user's name is, what email they're currently looking at in Gmail, what they just did, what's in their shopping cart, canonical example. How do you remember what's in a user's shopping cart? Well, what Amazon needs to do is maintain a bit of RAM on the server inside of which is this book and that book and the other book, or at least the ISBNs thereof, or however they do it, but you need to somehow link that information to the user. Well, what J2EE allows you to do through the JSP and servlet specifications is transparently remember who the current user is. The underlying implementation of this remembrance is with cookies. But for you, the developer, maintaining state on a per-user basis is as simple as doing something like this. If you want, upon having a servlet access, to check, do I know what this user's username is? Well, you can simply say request.getParameter and then some variable. All right. What is the value of the user parameter? Well, let's store it here. If it's null, well, then I'm going to throw a servlet exception just so that we can see what happens for demonstration purposes. But otherwise, I'm going to do this. I'm going to grab what's called the session. Think of a session as an object that is specific to the current user, whoever they are. No matter who is visiting your web server, if you call request.getSession, you get a chunk of RAM back that is specific to that user, and you can trust that it's specific to that user, whoever they are. Excuse me. So what are we going to do? what we're going to do is get this session, calling it SESS, and then what I'm going to do is get some attributes from the session. Specifically, I'm going to get the attribute called user. So I'm in this session object, going to get what's the current username, and then I'm going to check how many times they've been here. Well, if I get back a null object, that means the user's never been here before. I never set an attribute for this username, so I'm just going to instantiate a new integer and initialize it to zero. And what I'm going to then do is take the session object and set the attribute called user to be this value. Which is throwing away the memory I previously allocated, so we'll fix this later. But the point is that this line here is setting the attribute called user and storing in it the value, storing in it the value of the current integer plus one. Now I see some glossy looks. Let's try to explain this perhaps by actual demonstration. If I go to, not the parameter servlet, but the visits servlet and hit enter, notice, am I passing in a user parameter? No. So what's going to happen? That servlet exception that I promised. This is what a Tomcat servlet exception does. And notice that the error message is there, because I did include a servlet error message, missing user parameter. That came from my servlet code. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's expecting a user parameter. So let's say a question mark, user equals Malin. Enter. Well, what just happened? Well, the font is kind of small here, but there we go, a little bigger. So what just happened conceptually in the back end? Had this servlet ever seen user Malin before? No. So it instantiated a new integer object, initialized it to zero, and then took that integer object, incremented it by one, and saved the result back in the session. If I now visit this page again by hitting refresh, what's going to happen? The servlet's going to get that request. It's going to see, oh, this is user equals Malin. Let's get the session object for user Malin. Let's check how many times he's been here, and let's display it. So refresh. What's it been, Malin? One time, two, three, four. The more times I hit refresh, the more times that variable is being incremented. But notice, if you watch down here, every time I click refresh, the connection is dying after the response is received. It's stateless. The cookie I'm using is a session-based cookie, which means if I quit that and then go to it again, the session is destroyed. So it's clearly not persistent. It's only being saved on a per-RAM basis. But it is working, and why is that? We'll take a look again at classes visits.java. What we're doing here is we're checking, did a parameter called user get passed in from the HTML form? If so, store it in something called user. Then go ahead and grab the session object and then check what the current value of this username's value is. Store it in an integer called visits, and then assuming it is there, go ahead and push it back onto the session, again with user, storing the new value plus one. And all this integer stuff is because what you can push onto a session object is a string followed by an object. In other words, it's a hash table. A session object is a hash table. You can push onto it keys in the form of a string and then any kind of object, which means in Project 3 and in Project 4, for instance, you're going to be implementing Scamazon, which is this e-commerce website. You're not going to be remembering just the current user's username. You're going to be recording their current shopping cart as they browse your e-commerce aisles and add sports equipment to their shopping cart. What you can do then with a session object is transparent to you, for the most part, is remember on a per-transaction basis what the current user's shopping cart is, because every time you call get session, you get back the current user's session object, which is a chunk of memory dedicated to that user. How does the servlet container know what user gets what chunk? The cookies. And all of that is transparent to you. You never need to set cookies yourself. The servlet container does all of that for you and creates the illusion that to get user-specific information, you just grab the session object, which is like a hash table onto which you can push anything. The alternative, or perhaps the most obvious implementation of this otherwise, might be to do something like this, like a private string username, and we'll initialize it to nothing. Well, unfortunately, if you start using instance variables like this, and you store Malin in this username, unfortunately, how many users does your application now support? One. Because if you're using private, or rather instance variables, they are specific to the servlet. But you're only using this, you're using the same servlet for everyone. So if I visited this website and then Roman visited this website, he would clobber my username and you wouldn't have the illusion of an application that supports any number of users. You would have an application that supports one user, and if two people try to use it, things get become messy. And that's why a session, again, is like an object you get back from the servlet container that is user-specific onto which you can push anything you want. In this case, I am pushing an integer called users. In Project 4, you will push an object of type shopping cart or something like that and call it shopping cart or something like that. But the short answer is whatever you can push onto a hash table, a hash map, you can do with the session object. The idea is the same. Questions? Okay, so what you've seen in these three very simple demonstrations is one, how you access parameters, and that's going to be important. And two, how you actually can remember information on a per-user basis using the session object. And that's why in this slide here, we playfully equate the notion of sessions with the idea of a shopping cart, because it's with sessions that shopping carts are themselves actually implemented. I promised earlier we'd come back to this issue of what if cookies are off? If you disable cookies, is all lost? Can a server still remember who you are across HTTP requests? You can look at the IP address, but very dangerous for security reasons, because you can have a NATed network of 100 users, and you're going to be conflating each of them for each other. But have you ever seen URLs that are typically of a form like question mark, session ID equals, and then you get a really long string like this? What certain web servers or application servers will do, if the server detects that the cookie is not being saved, it will then start using get strings and passing in essentially that random number via the get string to circumvent the whole cookie mechanism. It's not ideal because it's no longer transparent. Also, if you try copying and pasting that URL into an email and saying, here, look at these flights that I just pulled up off of Expedia, often doesn't work because by the time your friend sees the URL of the possible flights you guys can take wherever, well, that session object has expired. Because you can specify in like server.xml or web.xml timeout values for sessions, which is to say if this session object is not touched after 30 minutes, kill it. And that's what's happening if your friend isn't reading the email for, say, 30 minutes. And that's in web.xml. Synchronization. And we'll use this as a segue to our peek at Project 3. When you write multi-threaded code, synchronization becomes a problem. What do I mean by multi-threaded? I'm sorry? You might share resources. So an application, a process, whether it's a web server or any process running on a computer, can spawn multiple threads. And what is a thread? Basic definition. And I'm going to go with this one. A thread of execution is a common way of describing it. A thread is like a mini process. It's every process, rather, has at least one thread. And most processes that you've probably written before, or most software that you've used, has at least one thread. And for the most part, processes and threads are indistinguishable. But processes can have multiple threads. For instance, recall the innovation from 10 years ago of background printing. There was a time when in Microsoft Word, if you went to print, you'd hit Control P, Enter, and then what would happen? You get a little window, and it would say waiting, waiting, and you'd have to wait until the program sent all the information to the printer. Well, enter the world of better design and use of threads. You can simply have nowadays software like Microsoft Word, where when the user hits Control P and hits Enter, a new thread is forked off, which in effect is like running immediately a new program, but it's a program within a program that handles the printing process, whereas the primary thread continues to allow the user to edit their document, change the bold facing, and so forth. So in a web server like Tomcat, how many threads did we say were allowable? We said 150, which is to say that Tomcat is currently configured to support up to 150 connections simultaneously, which might be moot if the requests are so simple as to be handled serially anyway. But suppose that the requests are coming in for search Harvard's web server, you know, search a large database of information. Well, each HTTP request might require 10 seconds of processing power. Well, what it means to have 150 threads available is that you can have 150 threads, 150 requests being handled not in series, but in parallel. Granted, all of them would slow down, but they would all finish at roughly the same time. Contrast this with now a web server that has just one thread. If you get 150 requests, probably 149 of them are going to time out, and the users are going to kind of keep having to try to hit the server. So what threads allow you to do is to create, is allow you to scale better and use the same software to support multiple connections at once. Unfortunately, if you are sharing resources among those threads, then things become a little problematic. For instance, consider the following classical problem. You're living in a dorm room, or a home rather, and you have a refrigerator, as does your roommate, and you open this refrigerator and you realize that you are out of milk. Okay, so I'm person A, and I realize, oh, gee, we're out of milk. What are you probably, if you're a good roommate, what are you probably going to do? Okay, so you go to the store, and the store is going to take 10 or 15 minutes. Here's the problem. Suppose roommate comes home, goes to the refrigerator. What do they realize? You're out of milk. So now what does the good roommate do? Well, person B similarly goes out to the store to get some milk. Person A returns home, puts milk in the drawer, effectively incrementing the milk counter in the refrigerator. Person B comes home, he returns the milk. What happens again? Well, how many bottles of milk do you now have? Two, when the goal really, in this case, was to have just one. In this real-world example, how do you solve this problem of synchronization so that the two threads, A and B, are not mistaking the situation for something that it's not? What's that? Okay, so we could, that's not a bad analogy. So we could lock the door. So I, person A, realize, oh, we're out of milk. I close the door and I lock it. Will there now be a predicament where if we take, don't take some liberties with our story here, where the roommate will similarly realize that the value of milk is zero and therefore go get more milk? No, what's going to happen? Well, roommate B is going to come here, and if the only purpose in life is to get more milk and check milk, he's going to lock here. He's going to stall. He's going to go to sleep, as they say in the world of multi-threaded programming, and he's going to sleep until this lock comes off. Well, I get back from the supermarket. I put the milk in there, so now its value is one. I remove the lock. My roommate can now be triggered to awaken. He can open the door. He realizes that the count of milk is one, so he does not go to the store. And so we have synchronized the problem of checking the value and setting the value of milk. Now, how the heck is this relevant? Well, you'll see that this very simple example comes up all of the time when you start writing multi-threaded applications, because no longer can you assume that you, in the sense of you writing the code, are going to be the only one modifying these variables. Because if you have shared state, not session state, but shared state, like an instance variable, as we posited earlier, unless you impose some kind of synchronization on the access of and modification of that variable, you could end up having variables clobbered or data lost. As in that case, we did not want milk to go to value 2, but there was that capacity for that problem to occur. So Project 3 is all about content syndication. You will be making use of a company called Moreover.com's news feeds that provides you with a whole bunch of content syndication, essentially news feeds on politics and sports and weather and local news and all the sorts of typical news feeds that you might imagine. They provide all these news feeds in XML format and freely available for our purposes, which makes them perfect for integration into a portal. What do I mean by portal? Well, this is a term commonly tossed around, but Yahoo kind of likes to think of themselves as a portal. It's a website that coalesces a whole bunch of information and is often customizable. So you can put your favorite movie listings up here, and you can put a clock up here and the weather down here. That's what we mean by portal, where it's sort of a user-customized website that has a lot of information integrated into it. Well, Project 3 is about implementing a J2EE application that parallels some of the ideas from tonight, and at the end of the day is actually a fully fledged application complete with user-based authentication that multiple users, yourself and say all of your friends that you brag to once the thing is working, can actually access, not only in series but simultaneously. And if implemented correctly with proper synchronization, it will not even appear to the other users, load aside, that other people are using the system. The framework for Project 3 is as follows. The client tier up top is going to be a user interacting with Wahoo, as we call it, with a web browser. It's going to be a website, this application, ultimately. In the middle tier is going to be the juicy stuff. There are going to be three servlets, one called login, one called prefs, one called view. In short, the login servlet, as you might guess, is going to handle the authentication layer. And we've implemented that for you. So out of the box, you have an application that does support user creation and user authentication. The only problem is once you log in, you don't see anything. Because not implemented are the prefs servlet and the view servlet. In short, the prefs servlet allows a user to subscribe to zero or more news feeds. And by news feeds, I mean different categories of news. The view servlet, not surprisingly, actually displays to the user once they log in what news feeds they've subscribed to. And I don't mean just the feeds themselves, but I also mean the top 20 stories from that feed for the current day. So the prefs servlet, again, allows you to customize what you're seeing. The view servlet lets you actually see it. The user manager is a class that runs in the background that handles with a back-end database, a back-end tier, if you will, the whole user database, which for simplicity and for highlighting some of these ideas we've discussed is implemented not as like a MySQL or Oracle instance, but just as a flat XML file that stores username, passwords, and subscription information. News provider, meanwhile, is a class that we also wrote that handles the retrieval via HTTP of the news feeds from Moreover, which is the third-party server to which you'll be connecting. Synchronization is not something you'll likely have to think about a huge amount for this project because we implement it for you. Consider, after all, that it's in this user manager where all these arrows converge that you conceptually have synchronization issues. Because suppose that I log in from my laptop and I decide, you know what, I want to create a new account with username David. Well, suppose that someone else elsewhere in the world similarly accesses your portal at the same time. Well, at that moment in time, there does not exist a user David. So I type in, log in as David, create the account called David. Suppose that almost simultaneously, he too says, I want to create a username David. We both hit enter. If the back-end user manager code checks the user database, just as our silly example was checking the refrigerator, the answer to both users might be, no, you can have that username because David does not yet exist. Because if one checks, but then the other thread gets scheduled, so the other guy checks, both answers might be, username David does not yet exist. You can have it. Which means my code for both computers A and B is going to create an account which is going to have this guy's password, but then clobbered immediately by this guy's password. And now both of us think we have accounts, but somehow or other, there's one account with one password and only one of us knows it. And the reason for that is that if you don't synchronize the user manager, that is to say, you don't lock the database when you do a lookup on it and only give an answer to one person at a time, you get this problem of synchronization. And the key there was, just as before with our story of persons, roommates A and B, notice that at one point I was off to the store and the other roommate got scheduled. That is to say, that thread, B, can operate while I am temporarily put to sleep. Right? After all, how many CPUs do most computers have? One. So even though you might be running multiple things at once, you're really running this thing, then that thing, then this thing, then that thing. So the story, in fact, is that computer A might check the user database and then get put to sleep by the operating system so that thread B, computer B, can similarly check the database. So even though it's with low probability you would have these collisions, when you start to write software that's meant to be used by hundreds and thousands of users, combinatorially, you start to get much higher probabilities that you're going to have bugs. And they're hard to diagnose unless you impose synchronization from the outset. So you'll see in the code walkthrough in the spec, as well as in the source code, how we synchronize this code. And in Java, it's often literally as simple as declaring a method as not just public and void or whatever, but as synchronized, which essentially means that only one thread can execute this method at a given time. It essentially means once one thread executes this method, a lock gets put on the method. And only once that thread exits the method can the next guy come in. And that's how it's done. So what you'll be doing with project 3 is essentially as follows. In your project, project 3 directory, you have a setup very similar to what we just saw. Slightly more files in it. In conf server, you again have this port issue. So I'm going to again, and don't take 8000 or 8080, because those are the first values I always think of. 8080. I'm going to now run ant, because whereas the demo code was pre-compiled before class, ant is now going to compile the view, the servlet, and the prefs servlet for you. It gets put in the proper location according to the build file. I'm going to run tomcat. And now, when I go to ice1.fas.harvard.edu:8080, I now get my web portal. Unfortunately, though there does exist one user by default whose username is jharvard with password crimson, there's your view servlet. So that's as much as you get. So you'll find that Project 3 takes great care in walking you through a lot of the code, because there's a great deal more directory structure here. But it's very reminiscent of the demo we did tonight. What we'll do in section tonight is do, as we usually do, more of a code walkthrough and give you a bit more empowerment when it comes to looking at this stuff. But with the spec alone and the ideas that we discussed tonight, I think you're well on your way to doing a great deal of Project 3. And in section, what I'll do is do a quick run-through of the question numbers and tell you what you can and can't do based on just this lecture alone. But much of it you can actually do starting immediately. So help yourself to some crispy treats on the way out, and I will see you next week.